Welcome to our first Salon of the Post-Festival World. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome Claire Crowther to our Ledbury Poetry Salon. Claire Crowther is a widely published poet, and her first collection, Stretch of Closures, was shortlisted for the Olber Prize for first collection. She's since published various pamphlets, and her latest collection is On Narrowness, which has come out with Shearsman Books. And she has had poems and reviews appear in numerous anthologies and publications, including PN Review, Poetry Wales, the London Review of Books, Magma. And she lectures, runs workshops, for example, on the Poetry School MA, which is a new thing. And actually, they're wonderful, aren't they, the Poetry School, for providing these opportunities for learning. And she recently finished a year-long residency at the Royal Mint, which sounds wonderful, as well as another residency. Was that with a sculpture?
Yes, I'm going to read a poem from
that. Oh, are you? Okay, so really interesting. So please do put your hands together to welcome Claire Crowther.
Well, I'll stand, because I think you read poems better if you're standing. They seem to come out more strongly, or perhaps I've just got a very light voice, but so I'll help myself along. Anyway, thank you very much for inviting me, Claire. It's brilliant to be here, and I don't say that as a platitude. It is brilliant to be here because I have spent about 5 hours being diverted by various things today. We set off the normal route to the station. There was a big diversion, which we took and then got lost. We then panicked because the train was going, so turned the car around on the main road, got followed by a police car who pulled us over.
No.
I was thinking, got to the station 1 minute before the train went, there wasn't a single car park space left. Huge car park. Can't believe this. Parked in this piece of waste ground where I hope we won't get tickets for it, not a problem. Anyway, it's worth it. Went up to find the train was 4 minutes late, so we got on it and got along, and halfway along the train stopped and debouched us all and said, you've got to go to some other station because the train's stopping here. I'm not going to get to Ledbury. God doesn't want me to do this reading, clearly, so if you could take that as a warning. But anyway, so I'm delighted to be here. And, I'm going to read from my three latest publications, because they all came together recently after a couple of years of building stuff up. Like buses, they all came together, and so I've had two pamphlets and a full collection out within the space of 12 months. It felt like really hard work, but was a lot of fun. So I'll read from the collection first, full collection first. It's called On Narrowness, and I was thinking a lot about the constraints of being a single human being, you know, as in singular, and what that really means. And of course, that's not accurate or true even, but I was thinking for a couple of years about that. And I came to see narrowness not as a constraint in a negative way. It seemed to me actually a very positive thing. Just like form is in poetry, every poem has got a form, and that's actually an enabling thing. I don't think there is a poem without a form and a formality. What's it? A formal feeling comes, you know, that's going to produce something in the end. So this collection is in the light of that, if you like, and I'll start with the title poem, On Narrowness. I'll just say about this poem, well, two things. It's very short, so you can go to sleep later, but this one you will miss if you go to sleep. And the word caryatids, you probably all know that, but it's either side of a doorway, a space, holding the lintel up, holding the space. On narrowness. Because we stand between stacks like librarians, walls form, small space, vertical, hard to move in, but caryatids everywhere welcome our love. I'm going to read a poem which is a homage to my parents, my mother particularly, and actually my mother loved Ledbury. She lived in Kidderminster and she would come on trips here. She just loved coming. So I have a good feeling about her when I'm here. And my mother had a big constraint. This poem refers to time in her life when she did, which she was Irish and she wanted to work in the civil service. That was her ambition. But she couldn't unless you had passed your Irish language, and my mother couldn't pass the Irish language exam. She was a very devout Irish, you know, supporter, but she hated the Irish language, sorry to say. And so she had to come over here and be a nurse, and she liked nursing. So she got over here, and I think the second hospital she worked at very shortly after training, my father was there, and he had a huge major constraint, which was that he was dying. And the doctor said to her, and I think they must have seen she was kind of getting fond of him, they said, don't get interested in that one, because that one is going to die. It was TB, and this was the days before antibiotics, and you did, you know, usually die of it. And he was very ill. And anyway, the story in our family is that my mother's love saved him, and they were very devoted to each other. He died at 49, though, which was still quite young, but they had a brilliant marriage till then. TB Hospital, 1944. His nurse said, "In the tar of the roof above your ward, lichen patterns have the look of Irish turfs after floods. His chest inflated like a pyramid, huge, with blank walls built by hand and unexplained vents. Folding the corners of his sheets to envelopes, she described the black and tans, a haggard, the taste of soda bread." A translator can add only humility to the original. She took away his dish of spit. She found herself robbed during their marriage, like a tomb. "Doesn't death grip the road with ice," she often said, "yet the sun hauls up each crystal." And this next poem is I wrote as a result of the residency at the Sculptor Gallery, which was a gallery devoted to the work of Dora Gordine, who was very famous. She was Estonian, but she came to Britain first half of the 20th century, and she was mega successful, and she did big public works, and everybody loved her. And then round about the middle of the 20th century, her star waned, her style just went out of fashion, and by the time she died in the 1980s, she was lonely and I think quite sad. But her work was all preserved, and you know what wasn't sold off, and there was this gallery which was the house that she built, and so it was there. And I'll tell you a story about this, which is in the light of a theme of the book. I was doing this residency, so I went along on the second occasion, and it was a gallery that was closed to the public mainly, so you know it was locked up. So I knocked on the door, and nothing happened. I knocked again, and the door opened a crack, and a face peered out. It was the security guard, and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, I'm the poet. I'm the poet in residence." And he said, "Oh, well, you better come in." And by this time I was saying, no, it's fine. But anyway, he dragged me in and dragged me down to the basement, which you should never do. Down I went to the basement. He said, listen, what can you hear? I can't hear anything. So I said, nothing. And he said, well, listen to my mobile. I've recorded it. So I listened to his mobile, and I could hear distinctly footsteps walking this way, that way. I could hear footsteps. And I said, I can hear footsteps. He said, it's her. It's Dora. She's in the galleries up there. She's walking around. This is Dora Gordine, who'd been dead 30 years. So I said, well, like, you know, calm down. Think about this. And, you know, but eventually the curator came back from where she'd been outside and came in. And we quieted him down. And I went in the office and said, close the door behind me. And I said, you'll never guess what the curator thinks has been happening while you've been out. I said, he thinks Dora Gordine has been walking around in the gallery. And she said, I wish she wouldn't do that. She does it every time I go out. She hates me going out. She hates all of us going out. She steals our keys. The worst thing was, apparently she once, so the story went, taking the curator's keys and hid them in the laundry basket. And they all believed that Dora Gordine was stuck. Her spirit was stuck there. She was unhappy. She died unhappy. And she didn't like being left in this house. And she wanted everyone to stay there and make much of her. So I felt I had a wonderful residency, actually. I liked being with Dora. I did never hear her apart from the mobile. Anyway, this is based on drawings in a room, drawings made by Dora Gordine. captured women. And in that house there was a room that was hung with many drawings of women with their mouths tight shut, lips making a point. Why do you stand in front of us? Why stand there? Why not go? One dipped her curls forward thoughtfully. Why don't you hang? When will you go? Their hair, serious expansion of each, upwards, sideways, a boundary against the questions. Why are we on the brink of you? The pencil asked what hair weighs and drew it to cover the tucked away technology of ear. Listen, the captured women ask, why do we hang in front of you? Why hang here? Why don't we go? The jib of them, their hissing sound like woodpeckers or worried finches considering a swing at the seeds before flight from the sparrow hawk. Why do we hang here while you stand? Why don't we go? Why don't we go? I think one of the weird things about constraints, if you've got a good, happy relationship, which I'm lucky to say, I shouldn't say it, should I touch something, I have a very happy relationship, then when you're together with that person, you actually feel free and like everything's fine, you can do what you like and you're not constrained, even though they're there and you should be thinking, well, I better not hog the bathroom for 5 hours playing silly music. But you just kind of feel free, whereas when they're away and you're separated, you feel kind of constrained and you don't quite feel free. Which is, I think, is a strange thing about separation when you're happy in a relationship. So this is about that. Separation. Snails might shout, crawling from mint to balm, I burn. Or call from Lovage and Hosta, I'm burning dry. While my husband is falling asleep in the sun away by Mooka Beck, where oyster catchers freeze on their nests and only water stays awake, irritably controlled, pushing stones, stuck, 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 till we both are woken by pain with its orange beak. This is the major constraint, the major narrow thing is the coffin and death. So I've written a few poems in the voice of a person who has already died, and this is one of those poems. It's in the voice of an astronomer who lived in the 20th century, 1941 to 81, Beatrice Tinsley. She was North American, and she did great astronomy, textbook stuff now. So she was really ahead of her time, and but she had to suffer to do that. So when she graduated, she wasn't allowed to be appointed to her own department because her husband was already working there. So she had to leave home, and she left her kids and her home to get the job she knew she needed to do for her work. And it cost her emotionally a lot. Her letters show after she died, her letters were published. So this is in the voice of Beatrice Tinsley. Coincidence of bodies. The heavier I was, the more I shaped space round me. Mass curves space. Come on, eclipses, you never could have blocked me. I curved new space. But my own flesh was moon. It eclipsed the larger body of sun in the coincidence of distance that makes them equal, that allows measurement of the bend of stars. I was flesh. Had I been only that mass coordinating old allegories that must be love or sensuality, I would have appealed for the fleshlessness I have now. I'd have begged not to be. a monument of blood. And if I'd survived till fallen flesh changed my shape so it wasn't hunted or held up, would I have resolved the paradox of flesh? That I was made of more than I am. Mars, you wore a helmet half off to show us flesh is too frail for battle. My fabric now is lighter than flesh, the blue of galaxies. I am what has been proved of the coincidence of bodies, given I'm not short-lived and can eclipse. I'm going to finish this bit of the readings from this book anyway with a science fiction-y poem, because referring to that separation thing I was talking about earlier, it is lovely sometimes to be with your much-loved person, and the sun is shining maybe and things are good, and you think, if only this could go on forever like this. And of course it can't, and you know that, so this is a poignant and difficult moment and you're constrained by time, but you think, if I wasn't, how wonderful it would be to be here in this moment forever. So this poem is about that, and it does mention my partner Keith, who's sitting right there actually, and he's written a book called The Burning Answer, so that's what I'm referring to here. Gold moment, 3000 AD. We chose to be made immortal in our garden at 60 degrees. Our bench was commissioned from big elite metal. They pop by to shine the alloy almost as often as we're serviced. Our thoughts on never dying have been etched to flash permanently on the kitchen window. Those herbs can't help now, but oh, the smell of bergamot. Keith never dozes. He's reading two pages of The Burning Answer. I try to think a poem through glaze. It fails. Revisions involve change in time. We ordered this gold moment. Don't imagine we're not alive in it. Our hearts beat. Our blood pours through. We are warm. The children hate it.
A wonderful opening reading, I think we'll all agree, and there's so much in this book, I have to say. Some of the lines, which I think you heard then, just have this amazing, sort of precision, but sort of wonderful physicality, crunchiness. I mean, it's been a great joy to read. But I wondered, just beginning simply to say, you know, did you set out with an idea to meditate on sort of constraint and those ideas, and is that how the book formed itself, or was it more afterwards that you could see where you were going?
Yes, that's a very interesting question, because I think it's quite fashionable now to have a themed book and to set out into that theme as you would embark onto the water of a choppy sea, you know, but I've done that. The book before this, I did that. I wanted to write about grandmotherhood and ageing in that sense of passing on the generations. Mm. So I set off into that sea and I did it from that point of view, and that was kind of fascinating and gripping but hard work. So after that I was taking a break and I thought, I'll just let any old poem arrive, you know, and it'll just come. But of course, you are the person living through that period of time, 2 or 3 years, that you write poems. You are this consistent human being working things out in your life, and that flows into your poems. So of course they're consistently, you know, developing each to each, and so of course they do have a theme, and it's just a matter of finding what it is, because you're so close in. If you haven't set out with an idea, then you can't always see. Mm. And Matthew Hollis, who's a poet and also editor at Faber, said, yeah, a good thing to do if you've got a mass of poems and you want to get them into a book is to read them all and look for the word which keeps cropping up. And then he did this with his book Groundwater, and he found water, and then just put that in the title, it's going to work. And I did read through, and I didn't find a word cropping up, but I did find that what they were about, I did see then, you know, I did read through looking for a word, if you like, and in fact a notion, I realised what I was struggling with. It's to do with ageing, this constraint thing. I think it's to do with things apparently narrowing, culturally speaking, feels like they should be narrowing, and actually not feeling like that about life apparently narrowing as you age. So that's what I think I was working on.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Is that too complicated?
No, it's really interesting. It's really interesting because I hadn't... because there's such a range of poems in the book. So there's sort of... There's a wonderful long poem which begins with penance in a line, which is bunting, but expands into this sort of incredible meditation, which I thought on marriage.
Yes.
And I wonder if, you know, and then there's another wonderful poem about Joan of Arc. And so it seems to span all kinds of ages and people and places and ideas. But I mean, I did feel that one theme that was emerging for me was about, obviously, the constraints of being female. And the Joan of Arc poem is really strong about that. I wonder if you could say a bit about... whether you were deliberately exploring that. I mean, and I think the idea as well of people framed. So we heard that picture, didn't we, about the woman captured, and I hadn't realised it was a woman making the pictures. I thought I had the idea it was a man. You know, so I was putting on things which weren't perhaps there.
Which is okay.
Which is, yeah, well, that's...
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to do because you bring yourself to a poem, don't you? So it tells you about yourself as well as hopefully what the poet...
Yes.
But the woman thing is a very fair point, and I'm glad you make it because I would like to think... I would love to think I was making a contribution to thinking about women and the condition of women, which I think is problematic, has been in many cultures and it's in our own. I started off writing poetry without wanting to constrain it in any way. So I wanted to write, because I'd been a journalist actually, and you know how you have to constrain. Journalists is supposed to be where you write the truth, but of course you can't. And so I thought, I could be a poet and write what apparently is fiction, then I can write the truth. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah,
and I absolutely thought, this is going to be free, I'm not going to constrain it anyway. So what I found was I was writing about women all the time, you know, just a lot from my first collection onwards, though it's not really apparently about that, but you know, everything's about women. And it isn't until I've got to the Royal Mint and money that I start to think about writing about men. So I'm quite sure that this is focused on women. My second collection was about grandmothers as such. You know, that was a very female, totally female-based. But, you know, you try to be honest about your experience, and I'm a woman and I know what I've experienced, and it feels strange to talk in the voice of. I find it quite difficult to write in the voice of a man, for example. I know lots of men who write the voice of women, and I'm sure women write the voice of men, but I find that difficult. It seems to me in poetry I want to be really able to get what it feels like to just be this singular individual at this moment in time, you know, just to kind of get that out. And I'm a woman, and that's very much part of one's cultural experience. You know, it just is. And what I'm fascinated about now, and I would like to write much more and know much more, is that way in which womanhood genders are... they're not swapping, they're blending a bit, so we're getting a much healthier, I think, approach to gender. People will let this emerge, so we don't feel so completely off into one corner, whichever gender we're in. Having said that, culturally, there are stereotypes working, and I do work against them in my poetry.
Mm.
So, I hope most of my collections actually will be about that.
Yeah, that's it. And I mean, it is true that one of the things that you do amazingly in the poems is... have voices speaking, and there's a real sense of hearing these different voices, you know, and I think there must be such an art to that, because as you say, within the constraint of a poem, to give lots of different people voices. There's the wonderful poem, because one of the things that has, I did read, I think, about you, is that that you're one of our great surrealists. And there is a wonderful poem where the monks are dressed up in celebrity costumes, and various people are speaking, and it is this sort of joyfully strange world. So much delight in the strange. So is that, how do you cultivate, or how have you gone about sort of, is it something that's sparking as your...
Isn't that interesting that you mentioned the poem about with the monks in it?
This is a
poem based on a visit to actually Harvington Hall that I don't mention, but it's a Catholic, old Catholic house that old Catholic family lived in. And this is a trip that I made a couple of times. I'd come from a Catholic family and we would go there on a Sunday and visit. And so every detail in that, every detail is observed to have happened. And I've heard things. I make up the voice of the narrator because I don't have a son and she has a son.
Well,
but that was a slight, because I wanted to divert my family from feeling it was biographical, really. And I don't tend to write autobiography. And I don't feel constrained by autobiography.
But the
strangeness is in life. Do you not experience life as completely strange? Not only strange, but I'm slightly not sure what's going on most of the time. Like today. If I wrote the story of my trip to get here, people would think I've made it up. You seriously would think I've made it up. But I do remember, I am delighted by things which seem surreal, and life does seem to me the most strangest thing. And there is a joy in that. But I did an MPhil at one point, just to see whether I was serious about poetry, and I am, and I was. But I would bring my poetry to the workshop, there'd be four or five poets, and then the lecturers, and I'd read my poem, and there'd be this kind of laugh, I'm not sure it's supposed to be a funny poem. And after about 6 months, one of the major lecturers said, I've worked out what it is about your poems. It's how you think, isn't it? I thought you made it up, but actually you think like this. So I think that's what it is. I think it's... I don't try to become surreal.
Yes.
I don't try. It's
very delightful. I mean, they sometimes are funny and sometimes actually, strange or unnerving. Mm. So you seem to take us in all kinds of ways with it. And then of course, what you seem to do at the same time is when you describe something, the poem which mentions the technology of ear, has this kind of very sort of, well, almost like an objectification of something. Well, I want to say forensic. I know your husband's here, but I've read that he's a physicist. But you write a lot about the natural world, suns and moons and stars. But then there's this very scientific way of talking about things coming in. I wondered if you're sort of aware of using that, and because it is very, it does seem very effective for made me look, differently.
Yes.
You think, wow, I could never have thought of it like that, but it seemed so right.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, you do come up with words which are important to you, and a poem is a process of taking away unimportant words, getting to the bit. So that may well have been in an early draft. But having said that, I do a massive amount of work on the poems. I'm sure poets here will, I'm sure, well, perhaps you don't, but I do. When I write my first draft, it's not a great thing. I love it. It's my baby. You wouldn't love it. And so I need to grow it and nurture it. So I will be looking for a very precise way of... I know what that sentence I'm writing, that couple of lines in that sentence, that bit of stuff is about, but I know it's not quite said it, which is frustrating. And that's because I am a bit blurred by life, and it does all seem very imprecise and woolly. And so I will try and get the most precise definition. I will do a lot of word hunting, a lot of concept hunting. I'll do a lot of research into, if I mention the ear, I might just go and read up the ear for a couple of days. And so you do then come out with a sort of, sometimes a bit of a researchy thing, which I don't necessarily recommend, but it's kind of inevitable. And then you have to try and kind of pull that back into the idiom a little bit, so that it's not too odd. That could be, I hope it's not a fault, but it could be a...
Obviously,
the way
I think
it works. I don't know.
Yeah, the way the poems are does seem to me very much pushing at each word.
Yeah.
I would have said that. And the first time I read it, I just read it all the way and enjoyed. And then I did do little bits of sort of trying to find out what things meant if I didn't understand them. But that I don't think... that is necessary to do, but I enjoy that, and that's, I don't know if everyone else agrees, but it's a pleasure.
Can I just ask a question on that theme there? How do you know when you've reached the point where it feels okay? Is it cerebral? Is it emotional? Is it from the heart, or a mixture of all these things? Says, yes, that's fine, I'm happy with that.
Yes, that's a really good question, because it is a weird thing, and I do a wonder at this, but I do know. I get a shaft of joy. I get, whoa, yes, that's it, that's it. And that takes a long time to get to that. And I won't rest till I've got it, you know. And if I've got a line and I will have to keep working at that line. But so why you get this, that's it moment, why, you know, how do I know that's it, is another question. And I don't have the answer to how do I know. It's as though you embark on a poem knowing, like when you bring up a child, you kind of, if you've never been trained or hadn't, you know, maybe you'd be really hopeless if you'd never lived in a family, but I wasn't experienced with babies, and you somehow find your way with it, you know, because I think what it is you love the thing, you love the baby, so you're never going to stop trying to do more and more of it, and you love the poem. And I don't think it's easy to be a poet if you don't love it. You could be a journalist if you don't love it. Just do the thing, take the money, fine, and you know, bear being who you are. With a poem, being a poet, I think you actually have to love it. This sounds a little bit mystical and a bit...
No, it sounds like it's part of you.
Yeah, and you have to...
Is that emotional bond?
It is. It absolutely is emotional. It's an emotional moment. And it's such a joy, you know, and Keith will tell you, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'll be like, yes. It's like, oh, God. Actually, he's the same. He's a very creative physicist, actually. So he'll be wandering around the house going, yes. And I'll be going, yes. Or no, and crying horribly.
Time is coming.
Have you ever worried about a poem being sort of overworked or to the point of... perhaps how you can with a child, you can over,
yes.
Sort of,
oh,
and then that can get,
yes.
Is that ever a something, or
yes.
do you, and what
yes.
do you do if you feel like you've perhaps pushed it in so many directions that you don't know where to go next, sort of thing?
That's a really interesting question. The first answer to it is, oh, I wish that moment happened. But no, it doesn't happen that often. Usually it's just a matter of terrific amount of hard work for me.
Yeah.
So that's rarely a point I get to. But you can overwork a poem. And you can overlove it and, you know, kind of push it down. And what I do in order to make sure that doesn't happen, and this is why it takes me about 2 years for a poem to get out, you know, and there are lots of things along the way. I mean, publication in a journal is just one part of the process of knowing and having some kind of, you know, even the editorial feedback, not that they're telling you to do anything with it, it's just somehow that, you know, you do improve it and help it. But what I do is, and I think lots of poets do this, is to put it away and get it out again. And if you have left at least 2 or 3 weeks in between a read, or a month is better, then you get a slight detachment. You think, oh, that would be overworked. It's really that. It's mostly that kind of, oh, that's a deadline there, what do I leave that? And then you see this line that's just been floating there. And there is a point at which you get to a point where it feels very tight, you're very thrilled, you're very happy, and you're confident, and you do send it out.
Mm.
And you get then a much bigger critical detachment coming back. Or it stays out there and everyone loves it, but you still might say it's not good. But somehow you start to send it to the world, it gets its wobbly legs. By the time it comes into the collection, you're kind of pretty sure. But some of the overworked ones never get into a collection.
Right, yeah,
you might get a journal for them, but you kind of know they've you've killed them. Terrible, that is. It doesn't happen very often.
I don't know if anybody else wants to... Is anyone... any thoughts or to add? It's lovely that people are chipping in. I was wondering about if you feel that how your approach to writing has changed across each collection, because... One thing I felt was the way the poems are. They can have a kind of sense of that they move the lines. It's quite unusual. They're quite innovative in some ways, to me, it seemed, that you were sort of so... or they can sort of finish on a comma or this is that. So I was just wondering whether you have a sense of sort of pushing that as you move through your...
Yes, that's a really good... It's been one of the most exciting things to look at form or shape on the page, or to... involve the page more, and to always be thinking about what syntax is doing, what punctuation is doing. So when I started off, I was so concerned to just learn how to manage a poem. I didn't do so much of that, although, in other words, I was freer, so I used a lot of poems I thought I'd invented, because I hadn't. It's a high bun, actually, so I'd use some lines and some prose, some lines and some prose. And then I stopped doing that in 2 collections on. And about halfway along, I discovered syllabics. I don't know if anybody... likes that or knows about that. It's just a way of managing a line where you count the syllables and you don't make it have metre, you work against metre, and that just gave me a whole whoosh for a year or two, and there's a fair bit of syllabics in here. And so I was reading Marianne Moore, I don't know if you know her poems, and she was very much, she was a mid-20th century poet who did syllabics. She's just the syllabicist genius, really. And she would organise poems in this fantastic shapes on the page, and I started trying to do that, you know, and she'd happily hang a the at the end of a line or break a word up just to keep her lovely shape. And because she could, and because she was brilliant, and it was fine. And you know, and reading, you read lots of poetry going on, because reading is the most important thing. So anyway, you love to do it, so you want to do it. And so you discover lots of other ways of dealing with things, and you can't wait to try them out. And so there is always that process of, you know, I mean, you read someone like Alice Oswald, who's just done these wonderful things with. Do you know her latest collection? Anybody read her latest collection? You know, Tithonus? At the
Falling Awake.
Yeah, Falling Awake. Mm. The last bit of that, Tithonus, or Tithonus, that one. She mentions writing being, him writing, or I think it's him, someone who's almost dead, I suppose, writing, being like a sewing machine without any thread. You know how it makes the little sewing machine, making a little hole. And so she's got on the page these little tiny holes, along the edge, a little. That was the most thrilling thing. I wanted to rush off and find a way to put little dots and, you know, wish I can't do the sewing machine thing, but I could do something like that. Just, I don't know, I find that a thrill. So hopefully I will always be experimenting with formalities. And also it's what suits the poem, because you get a poem, you get an idea for a poem, and you get this lump of stuff, your first draft, and you think, well, you know what that's about, I'm beginning to glimmerly see, but how am I going to make sure that the shape and the way it sounds on the page and the way it comes off the page. I am a page poet, really. How is that going to be best served so it can be the strongest thing? And I want to feel free about that to do what I think will suit it.
Yeah.
Which obviously Alice Oswald does.
It has a wonderful effect of drawing attention and capturing, because some of the poems tumble down the page, but these ones, they kind of hold you and stop you, and that's really interesting as a reader, I felt. So
I hope it works.
Yeah.
Each one.
Well, we've got time, but we're going to have the second half of our reading. But if anybody would like to ask a question now, then this is a great opportunity. And of course, we will have our break, which is also another lovely opportunity to have a chat with Claire. But any thoughts? Yes?
I've just got a quick question. You talked about overworking a poem, and it does. Well, don't you keep your old drafts? Or do you chuck the debris away?
I don't chuck it away. Absolute juvenile. I didn't start writing until I was 50, and so the stuff I wrote when I was, but I wrote up till being 20 and then stopped because I started to read really, really good stuff and thought this is totally pointless. and I have chucked all that away, and that's, I think, now kind of a little bit sad, just at this old age I'd like to be reading it, but since I started at 50 I've kept it all, and it is a bit of the, you know, the stuff that you put in a drawer that you think hasn't made it might have some great lines, or some lines which work in another context. And the other thing about it is that, if you ever get, this is a terrible admission, not sure I'd say this, if you ever get commissioned, I'm not a poet, given I have a 2-year process, that can just give you a poem in a month, you know, but you do get sometimes commissioned, you say, I can't turn this down. So I go to my rag bag of absolute failures, and pick one out or two out and start to kind of work on them, but take them away from the dead, you know, cut the dead bit right out, but just take out the good stuff to get me going quickly and to have some of the work already done. So, no, I think anyone who's writing, everyone is writing here, probably don't throw your stuff away, because you just don't know. Having said that, don't necessarily show it much, but keep it. It's really valuable.
Any other questions? Well, let's have our second half of our reading then, if that would be
okay. Yeah.
Okay, that would be lovely.
Thank you. So, you mentioned the residency at the Mint, and that was a lot of fun. There are lovely people there. And I actually went to the Mint because I was a bit worried about physical coins dying. I think they probably are. And I was kind of worried that this whole history, for good or bad, money is so huge and problematic in our life, but the physical coin, I felt, represented something to various sectors of people. Anyway, so I wanted to go there, and that was lovely, and I did go. Anyway, I was very reassured I was there, because they make loads of coins there, gazillions every day for numerous countries apart from our own, so it isn't actually dead yet, the physical coin. But I wrote a lot of poems there, and I also wrote this longer poem, which is kind of a set of poems, but it works out to a kind of bit of a narrative, longish poem. And it's sort of based around the story of St. George, which you see on this sovereign, this gold sovereign, 1817 this was designed, minted I should say, and it was designed by Benedetto Pistrucci, who was an Italian, and at the time a very famous and cool European gem designer, and a very, very high profile. And the Royal Mint in Britain thought, well, we'll get him over, and then, you know, money's not too popular, it's a bit problematic, and so he'll give us, you know, a bit of edge, and people will think we're smart. And so they got him over, and totally pissed off the other designers, the British designers, this Italian coming over, and he faffed around and took a lot of money, but did produce this wonderful design, which I think is one of our best, George and the Dragon. And he never left, actually. He stayed in England till he died. So this picture of George, why it attracted me, is because, you know, the story of George and the Dragon, you know that, don't you? He's killing the dragon and rescuing the maidens. But it's been going for hundreds and hundreds of years, this story. And when you see pictures before this, you would mostly see him in this kit of armour, you know, military, all kitted out, which you would be if you were going to kill a dragon that ate people, wouldn't you? But this George is completely inappropriately dressed. He has got no clothes on at all. And there he is, dragon's there. Not only that, nobody noticed this till a couple of years later they noticed it, and then they recast the whole thing. He's got his lance, he's stuck it in the dragon, who is not at all dead, rearing up, about to eat him. And his lance is broken, and the sharp bit is lying on the floor. So he is there, totally naked, with a broken lance. This is not going to end well. And I just was very attracted to this young man, very vulnerable, very beautiful, and I just thought he was a real person. And so I wrote this story, which I developed the narrative of, I changed his story. So in my story, there is the city where the maidens are coming out of, the women are coming out of, and George is there, and outside, they're going outside, but they're not going to get killed by a dragon. They're going to the mint, which is out there outside the city, run by, as ours is in Cantrisant actually, run by women, and the mistress of the mint is delighted to welcome young women who want to be independent, get out of the stultifying city in their father's house and go and be independent, earn a lot of money and have fun. George does not understand this, so he tries to stop them, and the mistress of the mint sorts him out in the book and tells him all about stuff. So this is about Bear George, and it is, you know, one of my attempts to write about men. Lovely George. I'm just half in love with him. He's gorgeous. I'll just read the first two poems from this pamphlet. The George. When I look at a random sample of men called George, say King, Meredith, Elliot, Curious, Surtees. Only one is called a saint. If a man is a George, for my purposes, he is shaped, designed, cut, valued, minted in gold, and put into circulation free. The George. Its picture by Pistrucci shows a George, saint of course, killing a dragon, rescuing a woman. That's not my story of men. The skin moves on his muscle, sun over down land. A coin now abandoned. Re Pistrucci, classic copyist, stripping men of clothes as well as women, I warm to him. He dropped the model's toga, Bear George. Ex-frastic art, is that what you're calling this poem? Pistrucci, I say. He knew King George was no soldier. They were pissheads both. He dared George to find where coins end. Die. The bullet-headed punch. It's not to die for, coins. It's to remelt. And to visit the furnace that I say is famous for women's work. And this poem is really an homage to George Herbert. Now, I do mention various Georges in this book. You know George Herbert's poetry, wonderful, wonderful 17th century poet. And I'm sure you'll probably recognise the poem I'm riffing off from here. Love bade me welcome, guilty of dust and sin. I drew back, guilty of dust and sin. It's a fantastic poem. So this is a very small homage to that. And it's the coin talking to death. The coin who realises it's dying is talking to death. The coin, according to George Herbert. Death hugged me warmly. Naturally, I balked, wondering what he'd done. And sharp-eyed death noticing my recoil, and fulsome as a sun patted my hand. Look, all the figures show this is the way to go. Oh, but the cost a loss of made things makes, I can't begin to think how taking us out will spoil. My dear, it's just the brink of brilliant things. You must consider me and what I do. Then I knew I'd lost you. And I'll just read a few poems from here, which is it's actually too big for a pamphlet and too small for a book, this. This is pamphlets, apparently. There are some rules here and there, and they have to be 24 or 5 pages at the most, and this is 34, I think. So it's a chap book. I don't know what it is. Absolutely delightful to do this with a publishing house called Hercules. It's a small publishing house with a big name, and it's very, very brilliant publishing house, I think, and they just do a couple of books a year which have got a visual remit, so they take poems which have got some kind of visual aspect to them. And I was writing poems about silent film for a couple of years, which I loved. The silent film at the beginning of the 20th century, not contemporary art silent film, but that early stuff, the beginning of cinema. And there were so many aspects of it which were lovely, and the designer for Hercules played out here. So lots of stills from silent films and pictures of people making silent films. And I just think it's lovely in black and white pages. And so I thought I'd read a couple of poems from here. And this one mentions Metropolis in the title. That's a famous, very famous silent film. Have you all seen it? Yeah, it's a fantastic film, isn't it? So that is a still, not actually from Metropolis, but, you know, kind of ish. It's from a Russian science fiction film of the period, which is kind of a bit similar. And I'm riffing off about those wonderful things that silent film can show you, which is the silence and the sound and the black and the white, and also the social problems of the period. So there was racism, hugely, and that gets reflected on both sides in silent film. I have a homage to Oscar Michaud, who was a great black director of the time. He's not known now, but really made a lot of films to show a different society than Hollywood directors would be showing. So anyway, this is riffing on all of those things. Panchromatic, Metropolis. The new girl at work is not my colour. In the library of quiet, I sought volumes on silence and tidy racks of absent sound. The capacity to boom is blocked, as if speaking, banned, is all male voice, not our thoughts. She is my partner, and we are a hand of black and white. In the terrazza, 500 steps to the folios, The sun glazes petals of half-lit July above the desks. We touch arms. She's not my colour, but she is my shade. This is a little poem which is really looking at Greta Garbo, who was a silent star before she was a speaking star. And it is biographical, more or less, actually, roughly speaking. But the still that's with this one, I must tell you about, because this isn't a Garbo at all. This is a still from a five-minute film made in 1895 by Alice Guy Blaché, who was going to become one of the great directors, who you probably never heard of, but she made masses of films, was hugely popular and well-known in the 1910s and 20s. Anyway, she was working for a film company, and she said, I don't have to be in the office like this doing typing what they did in 1890. I can be a director. And they went, no, you can't. Anyway, she fought for it, and she got a lunch hour one day where they let her into a studio. And she went in the studio and made this five-minute film about the cabbage fairy, you know, where babies come from. So she has all these cabbages and real live babies, no health and safety, being pulled out by this actress who's laughing. You can see this film on YouTube, laughing her head off, pulling these live babies out. And I think Victorian women who were, you know, not supposed to know where babies came from, must have found this film completely hysterical. brilliant woman. So she became a director. A silent star among the hypocrites. One no-class teacher taught her most. A no-job boss employed her first. That no-bed boyfriend slept with her again and again. Many a no-couch counsellor offered her a handkerchief. The choir of no-church nuns prayed for her often. Some no-pill medic prescribed for her at last a no-screen rest of life. And I'll finish this reading with a poem which you mentioned. It's the one poem which overlaps with the collection. There's just one poem from here in that book. And it's Joan of Arc. So I'm glad you picked that out. Do you like, that poem?
I love it.
Yeah, I'm fond of this one, actually. And this is an interesting thing, just because you were talking about when poems are finished. I actually have a group of very good poetry friends, and we meet once a month, and we chat about each other's work, as, you know, is very common and good to do. And I took this poem along, and they ran through it going, no, you must cut this all up. And I went home, this is the only time it's probably ever happened. I thought, you know, they're completely wrong. I love this poem. It has to be like this. And if you love it, I think I was right, maybe. Anyway, they did say later they probably thought they were wrong about it. So here it stays, uncut. It's about Joan of Arc, and I was inspired by a film by Carl Theodor Dreyer called The Passion of Joan of Arc, which is a fantastic film. Extraordinary, about Joan's trial and death. She does get burnt at the stake at the end of the film. And it's a lot of close-up, a silent film with close-up on Joan's face. The emotions are extraordinary. You just find it such a moving film. It's brilliant. And Joan of Arc, of course, is a person that we all have been interested in. She's never gone away. A lot of women get famous and disappear. Joan of Arc's never disappeared. People always loved Joan. So I had to write about it. And this is a poem about a visitation she's had. She believed she was visited by saints and angels. Jehan Dark and the Angels of Battle. They were carrying elaborate armour when they broke in to lock me in. This metal face, these sleeves can't be undone. I think I'll suffocate. This hard face is so heavy that in itself it could kill. I pitied them when I saw them. Since they flew off, I haven't always been believed in myself. First they took off great muscular structures from their shoulders. those wings were steel. Put me in steel, I said. I was not touched otherwise, except to hear words ransack me. Word was, soldiers pray to me, as if I am what was brought of value. What I value, inside metal, is my galvanized skin thinks it's dominant. Helpless metal. Thank you.